On May 2nd, 2019, almost 28 years after Tricia Boccaccio was killed in Glenview, Illinois, the murder trial for Michael Gargiulo finally began in Los Angeles Superior Court. Gargiulo was on trial for the murder of two women, 22-year-old Ashley Elrin and 34-year-old Maria Bruno, and the attempted murder of 26-year-old Michelle Murphy. The prosecution team was made up of L.A. County Deputy District Attorneys Dan Aikman and Garrett Dameron. Gargiulo was represented by lead defense attorney Dale Rubin and Daniel Nardoni. After he was originally arrested in 2008, it took Gargiulo over 10 years to finally get to trial due to delays throughout the preliminary hearing, as well as Gargiulo changing lawyers multiple times, even representing himself for a few years. When the trial finally got underway, Gargiulo was a much different looking man than when he was initially arrested. His head was completely shaved. He sported a white goatee and black rim glasses. The judge presiding over the case was Los Angeles Superior Court Judge Larry Paul Fidler. The jury was made up of five women and seven men. The prosecution alone had nearly 250 witnesses. As prosecutor Dan Aikman began his opening statement, he showed pictures of the four women Gargiulo was accused of stabbing. Aikman called Gargiulo the boy next door killer, saying he would identify a target that lived close to him, then he would hunt them down and slaughter them, referring to Gargiulo's crimes as the methodical and systematic slaughter of women. Another focus for the prosecution would be the proximity of Gargiulo to each of the women. Later in the trial, the prosecutors even took the jury out to view the crime scenes in an effort to show exactly how close he lived to all four victims. Aikman also showed the jury pictures of all 47 stab wounds scattered throughout Ashley Elrin's body. Maria Bruno was also found with 17 puncture wounds. The chilling 911 call for both the Murphy attack and the murder of Maria Bruno in El Monte were played in the courtroom. The nature of how Elrin and Bruno were murdered was another key point to connect the crimes to Gargiulo, as well as multiple statements Gargiulo made to witnesses and his M.O. of watching his victims, stalking them until he attacked. The case would have four separate attacks to dissect. The jury was tasked with establishing Gargiulo's guilt in three of them. In Gargiulo's defense team opening statement, attorney Daniel Nardoni countered that over the course of the trial, the jury would see that no physical evidence linked Gargiulo to either of Ashley Elrin's or Maria Bruno's murders. He argued there were several other men who had better access and motives for killing both women, including the two men who were at Ashley Elrin's house the night she died, as well as Irving Bruno, the estranged husband of Maria Bruno, who had been out with Maria the night she was murdered. But there is no denying it was Michael Gargiulo who was at Michelle Murphy's apartment when she was attacked in April 2008. On day two of the trial, Michelle Murphy, the only survivor of the four attacks, took the stand. Let's bring in reporter Mark Mester, former anchor reporter at KTLA. Mark, how important was Michelle Murphy's testimony, and what do you remember about it?
Well, I think Michelle Murphy is the reason why this killer is behind bars. She was the one who was stabbed, I believe, more than a dozen times while in her home in Santa Monica. For whatever reason, this brave woman was able to fight back. And that's how authorities were alerted, and that's how, initially, that's how they captured Michael. But yeah, Michelle was essentially the missing piece to this puzzle, and had she not fought back, this serial killer would still very much be on the loose.
Michelle Murphy told the court how she woke up to find a man straddling her, stabbing her in the arms and chest with a serrated knife. Murphy demonstrated the attack to the court, showing how her attacker stabbed her repeatedly with his left hand. This was another key point for the prosecution because Michael Gargiulo was left-handed, and later evidence would show the other attacks, according to the DA, were also likely committed by a left-handed attacker. To try and save herself, Murphy wrapped her hand around the blade of the knife and kicked the attacker off. After the attack, Murphy said she locked the door and closed the window in the living room where the man had climbed in. She called her boyfriend first, who called 911 around 11:47 p.m. As police arrived, she was taken by ambulance to the hospital. She later underwent hand surgery, physical therapy, and counseling to deal with the effects of the attack on her. Murphy testified that she never went back to her Santa Monica apartment. She moved to a new place and had family and friends pack up her belongings. Santa Monica police officer Steven Smetzer was first on the scene. Smetzer also testified, telling the court he found a large amount of blood in Murphy's bedroom and living room. He also saw a shoe print on the railing below the open window where the attacker had cut the screen to gain entry, and a trail of blood leading from the front door of Murphy's apartment to the back alley where Gargiulo's apartment was. Murphy also told the jury that in the months before the attack, she would see Gargiulo in the alleyway, parked in his Gus the Plumber van. Murphy said he would wave at her from the driver's seat and did so as many as 10 times, possibly more than 20. Other than that, the two never interacted. One of Gargiulo's former co-workers, Aaron Miranda, later testified that he saw Michelle Murphy twice outside of Gargiulo's home and that Gargiulo would comment that Murphy was hot and that he wanted to get with her. He also described Gargiulo getting out of the van once to say hi to Murphy. Also testifying for Michelle was her then-boyfriend, Vincent Buono, who is now her husband. Buono described her as hysterical after she was attacked. He remembered telling her to leave the apartment and go to Wilshire Boulevard, which he thought was a highly trafficked area where there would be people on the street. Buono hung up, got into his car, and drove to Murphy. A third witness in the Murphy case was her roommate, Olga, who was in Poland at the time of the attack and didn't hear about it until days later. Like Murphy, she never returned to the apartment either. One of Gargiulo's old friends from Glenview, Mark Petridge, who stayed in touch with Gargiulo after he moved to California, testified that he met up with Michael Gargiulo and his then-wife, Ana Luis, in San Diego in 2008. Petridge testified that Gargiulo was acting nervous and out of sorts during the 2 days and even talked about planning to move to Mexico. He also noticed Gargiulo had a bandage on his hand which seemed to be from a cut. Gargiulo told him it was from work stuff. Remember, Michelle Murphy's attacker sustained a self-inflicted cut to his hand while she fought him off. Less than a week after Gargiulo left San Diego, Petridge found out Michael was being charged for murder. Chad Goodwin, a sergeant for the Santa Monica Police Department, was one of the two officers who transported Gargiulo to jail when he was arrested in 2008. Goodwin told the court that while Michael was being transported, he asked officers what agency they were with. Unlike the murder cases Gargiulo was accused of, his defense team did not challenge the attack on Michelle Murphy, but they continued to deny Gargiulo's involvement in the two California murders. And even though Gargiulo was not being tried for the 1993 murder of Trisha Boccaccio at the trial, prosecutors were still able to show jurors the evidence of Boccaccio's murder under the California Prior Bad Act statute. Let's bring back criminal defense attorney and former L.A. County Deputy District Attorney Joshua Ritter. Josh, what is the Prior Bad Act statute and how can it be used in a case like this?
Prior Bad Acts evidence, or different incarnations of the same idea, are used in other jurisdictions, but in particular in California, it falls under Evidence Code 1101B. And what that essentially says is, first, you cannot try a person just based upon their character. So in other words, you cannot present evidence in court of all of the bad things that a person may have done in their life. They were cheated on their taxes, or they committed different types of property crimes in an effort to prove that they committed something like murder. So we don't allow for a person to be prosecuted just based on their bad character. But there is an exception for prior bad acts or uncharged crimes if those crimes fall into certain categories that are helpful to prove something other than that person's character, meaning if you can prove intent or motive or a lack of accident or a common plan. There are several different exceptions where you can show that, listen, in a prior uncharged incident, this person, we can tie this person to having committed something remarkably similar to what they're being charged with here. And you can use that to prove that they were the person who committed this crime, or that they had a similar motive for the person that we're accusing of this instant crime. And it's incredibly powerful evidence because of the way that jurors naturally think. They think, what are the chances that this person would have done something so similar before? And especially if you have more than one prior bad act to present to a juror, it can be very, very powerful evidence. And it is a practice that's used often by prosecutors, but is also very closely watched because, again, judges and the appellate courts are concerned to be making sure that we are not prosecuting someone for their bad character. The other thing I should add of why it's so powerful is that those prior bad acts do not have to be proved beyond a reasonable doubt. So as long as you can prove those prior crimes, those uncharged prior crimes, beyond what's called a preponderance of the evidence, the jury can use that for its intended purpose. And preponderance is a much lower standard than beyond a reasonable doubt. Preponderance just means more likely than not. So that's where you will see uncharged crimes where it might be a crime where police and everyone else believe that person committed it, but they don't feel it's strong enough to have brought that crime as a standalone crime on its own. They'll use it as prior bad acts or 1101B evidence.
That could be very impactful evidence in a case. Ultimately, it'll be up to the jury based on the facts and circumstance to determine whether someone's guilty or innocent. But the fact that bad acts come in can significantly impact the case. To discuss the evidence in Trisha Boccaccio's case, her parents, Rick and Diane Boccaccio, testified, as well as Trisha's younger brothers, Douglas and Thomas Boccaccio. The Boccaccio family all testified that Trisha was known to be very clean, washing her hands and showering frequently. Rick Boccaccio also testified about how they would frequently fight about Trisha taking long showers and using up all the hot water. He also noted she had showered the night of August 13th before leaving for the road rally that night. Rick knew Michael Gargiulo as a kid from the neighborhood, even helping Gargiulo fix his car sometime before Trisha's death. He talked about his relationship with Trisha's brother, Doug, but said there was no relationship between Michael and Trisha. Then he recalled the morning he found Trisha. Trisha's brother, Doug, who was friends with Gargiulo from a young age, testified as well. He spoke about the night Trisha was murdered and how he and three of his friends had actually gone to the road rally where he saw Trisha. He was the last member of the Picaccio family to see her alive. Doug spoke about his relationship with Gargiulo, but said they saw each other less frequently by the summer 1993. But Doug did see Gargiulo the night of Trisha's murder. After attending the road rally, Doug testified that he stopped by a party with his friends, then returned home and planned to go see a movie. Coincidentally, it was Michael Gargiulo who drove Douglas Picaccio to the movie that night. Gargiulo and his then-girlfriend picked up Doug, along with his friend Jonas Lindgren, dropping them off later that night. The next morning, Doug Picaccio woke up to the sounds of his father screaming. Trisha's other brother, Thomas Picaccio, also testified. Thomas was friends with Gargiulo's younger brother. He also woke up abruptly that morning to the sounds of his older brother charging up the stairs, running into Trisha's room after seeing her dead on the doorstep. Thomas testified that Michael Gargiulo was among the neighbors who had gathered around the house, which was now cordoned off by the police. Thomas said when he finally went outside, police had to physically restrain his father, who was yelling at Gargiulo, "Who did this?" Friends of Gargiulo and Doug Picaccio were also called to testify about the night Trisha was murdered. His high school girlfriend, Allison, was particularly important for the Picaccio case. She was also with Michael, Doug, and Jonas that night. The next day, the same morning Trisha's body was found outside, Michael had called her around 8 a.m. asking her to come over because he wasn't feeling well. Allison said she had plans with her parents that day, but at 9 a.m., Michael called back, crying about Trisha Picaccio being murdered. She eventually went over to his house to comfort him. One day later, Allison was back in Michael's room speaking to him about Trisha's murder. Michael then said he had to get rid of some knives and told her not to speak to the police. Allison also confirmed that Michael hadn't had any contact with Trisha Picaccio before she dropped him off at home on the night Trisha was killed. Remember, Michael Gargiulo wasn't charged in 2003 because Cook County couldn't prove that his DNA on Trisha's fingernails didn't come from casual contact. The court also heard from two key witnesses in the Picaccio case, Teamer Leary and Anthony D. Lorenzo. Despite checkered past and spending time in and out of prison, it was Leary and D. Lorenzo's testimony to a grand jury that finally got Cook County state attorneys to press charges. The defense attacked their credibility and questioned why they were deciding to come forward now, particularly Teamer Leary. D. Lorenzo testified that Gargiulo brought up a murder in Chicago 6 or 7 times, originally saying the police were after him for a murder he didn't commit. But the key conversation happened in 2002 inside D. Lorenzo's car, where Gargiulo said he had buried the bitch and left her on the stairs for dead. Teamer Leary also testified. He spoke about seeing the CBS 48 Hours episode on TV, seeing Rick Picaccio speak about his daughter Trisha and how it broke him. He texted D. Lorenzo about it and posted the comment on Patch.com about his knowledge of Gargiulo before eventually speaking to Cook County detectives and a grand jury in Chicago. The defense attempted to attack his credibility, going over his text messages with DiLorenzo and how Leary had asked for immunity before testifying to the grand jury. Attorney Dale Rubin also grilled DiLorenzo on the different names Teamer would use, since he was facing charges in New York while he was in California. DiLorenzo said Teamer would use names like Michael DiLorenzo, Tony Stork, and while he was working at the Rainbow Room with Gargiulo, he went by Michael Stewart. Let's bring back Maureen Maher, former correspondent for 48 Hours. Maureen, what did you know about Teamer Leary when you spoke with him? Was his story credible?
I think Teamer would be the first person to tell you he's like the worst possible witness that anyone could have in any kind of case. Teamer for sure has a past where he's been in trouble. Throughout the 11 years that we were waiting for Gargiulo to go to trial, Teamer had been in and out of jail. And at one point when Doug Longini went to see him, he was in, I believe he was in a jail in upstate New York. I'm not 100% sure it was upstate New York, but like we had to visit him in jail to have a conversation with him. It's also one of the reasons we didn't put him on TV right away was like he had deep concerns about some past events in his life that if he got on TV, that it could cause more trouble. He really just wanted to get the information to Cook County. He didn't trust Cook County. And Cook County didn't trust him. And I really, to be honest with you, did not have a full appreciation for how tenuous that relationship was between Teamer Anthony and Cook County until years later when he got up on the stand during the trial in California and gave testimony as to just how difficult it was. And I think the defense used that in the LA trial. They used that to try to use it to their advantage that, you know, he didn't have a stellar past. This is a guy who he's got a record. And, you know, the prosecution doesn't normally like to deal with people who have records, but his testimony was pretty solid. I found him to be credible. Just because you have a record doesn't mean you're not credible. You have to find out what that person was in trouble for and does it relate in any way to the testimony. He was in no way offered any deals. He just wanted protection. And at one point during the LA trial, you know, the defense was going after him saying, but why would you need an attorney? What were you asking for? Why did you need an attorney? And Teamer yelled from the witness stand, because Maureen Maher told me to, which I'm not sure those were exactly my words. But when I spoke with him the day after we first ran the Gargiulo program in May of 2011, and he seemed extremely concerned about interacting with investigators, I said, you should have a lawyer to represent you. So I don't think I implied that that it wasn't a good idea for him to talk. It was more like, look, if you're concerned, take a lawyer with you. But all you need to do is tell the truth. And you have more than one person who heard Gargiulo say what he did. You have two guys. They both might have sketchy backgrounds. But if you have a lawyer there representing you, you can separate whatever it was that they did they got in trouble from before with the incredibly important and pertinent information that they're trying to pass on to Cook County in a case that has gone nowhere in decades.
Several DNA experts with the Illinois State Police testified about the DNA found on Trisha's fingernails, which matched Michael Gargiulo. Karen Abinanti, a forensic scientist with the Illinois State Police, is the one who did the testing on Trisha's fingernail clippings and the keychain found at the crime scene. Abinanti testified that she swabbed all eight of Trisha's nails using one swab and scrubbed the undersides and the top sides of all the nails. She told the court how the mixture found on Trisha's fingernails identified Trisha and a male profile that could not be excluded from Michael Gargiulo. Abinanti explained that ordinarily in that situation, she would expect to find a small amount of someone else's DNA on another person's fingernails. But in this case, there was just as much of Gargiulo as there was for Tricia. Avenanthi said that typically that amount of DNA from a foreign profile could be consistent with a struggle if there was scratching, punching, or something of that nature. She also testified that frequent hand washing would affect whether or not foreign DNA would stay on a person's fingernails. Remember, Trisha's family testified that she washed her hands frequently and had showered before going out to the road rally the night of her death. Interestingly, Avenanthi said she also found a partial profile on the keychain that matched Tricia and one other unknown individual, but that profile was not Michael Gargiulo. Greg D. Dominick, who was also employed by the Illinois State Police Forensic Science Center, also testified that when comparing the DNA from Tricia's fingernails, the male profile that was identified would be expected to occur in 1 in 98 billion black individuals, 1 in 390 million white individuals, or 1 in 5.7 billion Hispanic unrelated individuals. While the DNA and how it was collected became a key point of contention, remember, Gargiulo wasn't on trial for the murder of Tricia Boccaccio. As the trial continued, the focus shifted to the murder of Ashley Elrin, the first woman Michael Gargiulo allegedly killed after he moved to California. Key witnesses for Elrin's murder included Detective Tom Small, Ashton Kutcher, who was supposed to go out with Ashley the night she was murdered, Mark Durbin, Elrin's landlord and love fling, who admitted to having sex with her hours before she was killed, several of Ashley's friends, and a blood spatter expert who would testify about the crime scene. One of Ashley's roommates, Jennifer DeSisto, also testified about finding Ashley's body the next morning. She was asked about Ashley's dating five different men at the time she was murdered, including her apartment manager, Mark Durbin. The defense questioned her about these relationships and the friend telling detectives that Ashley would joke about having sex with multiple men just so she could use them. The next key witness was also the most famous one. Actor Ashton Kutcher took the stand to testify about the night he went to pick up Ashley for a party after the Grammys, but left when she didn't answer the door. Kutcher told the court that he knocked on Ashley's door around 10:45 p.m., but she didn't answer. He knocked again and assumed she had left for the night because he was late. Kutcher testified that he looked into the window and noticed a red stain on the floor, which he thought was red wine, and didn't think it was anything out of the ordinary. Kutcher's testimony was key for establishing a timeline for Elrin's murder. He last spoke to her at 8:24 p.m. over the phone to tell her he was running late. He testified that she told him she had just gotten out of the shower, but when he called her around 10 p.m. to say he was on his way, she didn't pick up. Kutcher also testified about finding out about Ashley's murder the following day. He said he went to detectives and said, "My fingerprints are on the door," and that he was freaking out. Kutcher was never a suspect, according to the police, and wasn't publicly linked to Elrin's murder investigation until 3 years after her murder in 2004, when Ashley's parents spoke with In Touch magazine. Her father, Michael, said Kutcher's behavior that night Ashley was killed suggests he felt she was a disposable date, adding that because of him, the perpetrator got a 12-hour head start. Gargiulo's defense team didn't cross-examine Kutcher. Instead, they use his testimony to point the finger at another witness, Mark Durbin, Ashley's apartment manager, who was the last known person to see Ellerin alive. Durbin told police he was in her apartment between 7 p.m. and approximately 8:15 the night she was murdered. According to Durbin, the two had sex around 7:15 and then he left while Ashley was getting into the shower. He said he left around 8:15 to get home to his girlfriend, who was to arrive home at 8:30. Defense attorney Dale Rubin hammered Durbin about the timeline and his own testimony of what happened while he was in the apartment. When Ashton Kutcher spoke to Ashley at 8:24 p.m., she said she was getting out of the shower. But Durbin testified that he was still there when Ashley was taking a shower. He also told police that while he was there, Ashley got a phone call and was making plans with another man. Attorney Rubin argued the call was Ashton Kutcher's call at 8:24, questioning how Durbin could have been in the house while the call happened and while Ashley was in the shower if he left at 8:15. When Rubin asked Durbin how that would affect his time frame, Durbin responded that it would certainly would, noting when he said 8:15 p.m., it could have been 8:25 p.m. He said it was possible he was still there at 8:24 p.m. when Kutcher called. Rubin was questioning the timeline of events because Ashley's neighbor, Todd Jackson, had testified that the night of Ashley's murder, he was walking his dog across the street and heard a woman scream between 8:15 and 8:30 p.m. Jackson said his dog alerted twice in the direction of Ashley's house. Durbin also testified that he called Ashley twice between 9 and 9:20 p.m., but Ellerin didn't answer. Prosecutors believe by then she was already dead. Durbin said he knows those calls were to Ashley because he remembers not being able to reach her. Attorney Dale Rubin asked Durbin bluntly about 6 phone calls he made that night, including one at 1:14 a.m., but Durbin said he couldn't remember if he had called Ashley or his girlfriend. Rubin also pointed out Durbin had a fresh cut on his arm that detectives had noted in a report. Durbin said he showed police the cut because he was worried he could be a suspect in Ashley's murder. He continued to grill Durbin, asking if he had ever spoke to his girlfriend, who was now his wife, about his affair with Ellerin. Durbin said they never discussed it, and Rubin accused him of lying to her for years. Several of Ashley's friends testified about Gargiulo's presence at the apartment in the weeks leading up to her murder. As Christopher Duran pointed out, Gargiulo had shown up to a party at the residence weeks prior. Anthony Castellani testified he actually offered to stay with Ashley that night because he was worried about leaving Ashley by herself after Gargiulo kept staring at Ashley all night. During opening statements, the prosecutor showed a photo from the party with Ashley and her roommates with 2 other friends. In the background of the photo, a shadowy figure could be seen looking on from the background. Prosecutors believe the man shown in the background was Michael Gargiulo. Another one of Ashley's friends, Monica Grandi, told the court about Gargiulo once opening the front door to Ellerin's home with the key. She said Ellerin was upset and yelled, "What the F are you doing here?" And she testified that Gargiulo appeared angry and said something about needing to check the furnace, but left the house after the exchange. Another key witness for the prosecutors was blood spatter expert Steve Shalibi, a senior criminalist for the L.A. County Sheriff's Department, who testified about the blood drops and the bloody shoe prints in the hallway of the Ellerin's crime scene. Schliebe testified that the bloody footprints were headed out towards the door, with the blood drops being generally to the left of the shoe prints. According to Schliebe, that indicated the attacker used their left hand to kill her. As the prosecution pointed out multiple times throughout the trial, Michael Gargiulo is left-handed. Ellerin's case relied heavily on circumstantial evidence because there was no DNA found at the scene and no witnesses who saw Gargiulo enter or leave her apartment that night. But a big part of the prosecutor's case against Gargiulo also relied on stories he would tell to friends, co-workers, and neighbors. Mirko Hoffman testified that Gargiulo, at one time a friend of his, liked watching America's Most Wanted to learn from criminals' mistakes and told him if he ever was accused of a crime, he plans to lie until you die. Hoffman testified that Gargiulo talked about the murder of a woman who lived a block away from him in Hollywood, sharing intimate details about the murder, including that the victim was attractive and got her head cut off. According to Hoffman, Gargiulo would also research forensic science online. Gargiulo's defense team tried to bar Hoffman from testifying, arguing he had researched the case online and accused him of being biased against Gargiulo. The next stage of the trial focused on Maria Bruno. Unlike Ashley Ellerin's murder, there was key DNA evidence at the crime scene of Bruno's murder. A blue medical bootie found just outside Maria's apartment had three drops of blood that matched the DNA of Maria Bruno. As Mark Lilienfeld told us, investigators also found DNA matching Michael Gargiulo on the elastic band of the bootie. We also spoke with Lilienfeld about the matching bootie found in the attic of Gargiulo's apartment, along with a Christmas card addressed to him. Susanna Netchel, a criminalist with the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department Crime Lab, testified about the DNA found on the bootie. The court also heard from several people who had interacted with Gargiulo, including some of Gargiulo's neighbors when he lived in El Monte. The apartment manager, Grace Urias, testified that when Maria Bruno moved into the complex, she was very concerned about security and mentioned her divorce from her husband Irving and didn't want him to have access. Urias also remembers Gargiulo asking her if he could put cameras in front of his apartment door. When detectives searched Gargiulo's apartment in the complex, they found a false bottom, which Urias said was not there before when she rented the unit out to Gargiulo. Another neighbor, Francis Jeremio, spoke to Gargiulo in the laundry room following Maria Bruno's murder. She said that Michael Gargiulo had told her that Maria's breasts had been removed and put in her mouth. But Detective Lilienfeld said that type of information wasn't even public, showing Gargiulo had intimate details about the investigation. He also remarked that police don't have blood at the crime scene. Brenton Dolson, another neighbor, testified that Gargiulo had spoken to him about Maria Bruno one day in the apartment complex, saying, "That's how I like him, thin with large breasts." Grace Quack, Gargiulo's girlfriend at the time, who he lived with in the El Monte apartments across from Bruno, testified that she had seen Gargiulo wearing blue booties for his job as an air conditioning repairman. Quack was on the stand to speak about their relationship, how Michael was physically abusive, stayed up all night, and would come and go at all hours. As Quack tells it, she grew tired of being abused, so she moved out on Thanksgiving weekend to move in with her parents. Days after the murder, Quack was with Gargiulo in a Pasadena restaurant when she came across an LA County Sheriff's Department flyer with Bruno's photo on it, and a composite drawing of a man Bruno's neighbors saw stalking her. After seeing the flyer and realizing it occurred in the same apartment complex they lived in, she spoke with Gargiulo about it. According to Quack, Gargiulo responded that he knew the woman and she was very beautiful. He also mentioned that he had once helped her carry her groceries inside. He also seemed to know intimate details about Maria, noting she drove a Mercedes, worked in a video shop, had kids, and was divorced. Defense attorney Daniel Nardoni questioned Quack about her interview with detectives, where she said she didn't think Gargiulo was living at the El Monte apartment back when Bruno was murdered. Quack responded that while they were living together, Gargiulo would sometimes not come home at all. She said she believed Gargiulo was spending much more of his time with another woman, Velma Carrillo, the mother of his first child. Maria Bruno had four children herself, with her husband, Irving Bruno. Another key witness for the Bruno case, Irving Bruno, testified next. He spoke about his relationship with Bruno, describing the couple as homebodies until 2005, when hiring a nanny allowed them to start going out and eventually led to Maria beginning to drink more. Irving testified that on two occasions he was abusive towards Maria, pushing her once years prior during an argument. But in 2005, the two had been out for a night and got into another argument in the car. When they arrived home, Irving walked around the car, threw Maria to the ground, and punched her in the eye. Police weren't called and no charges were laid, but Irving said that was the beginning of the end of their marriage, and they separated soon after that incident. As Mark Lilienfeld told us, Irving volunteered a lot of this information to police when he was interviewed after the murder. The Brunos did speak about divorce, but according to Irving, Maria wanted to give it some time and see where they are in a year. Irving also testified about the day before Maria was killed. He and Maria had spent the day together, taking their son to a doctor's appointment, Toys R Us, lunch at Denny's, then grocery shopping, and a carpet store to purchase some rugs for Maria's apartment. Later that night, the two went to a local restaurant called Carmen's and had some drinks. At one point, Maria went to the bathroom and cut her hand, which the restaurant manager helped her with. The manager also testified that Maria was sloppy drunk that night and had to be cut off by the bar. Irving said they eventually left the restaurant around 2 a.m., then after stopping at Irving's to pick up Maria's keys, headed to her apartment. Irving had to describe in detail how the two had sex, starting from the bathroom and then to Maria's bed. After Maria fell asleep, Irving said he got dressed and put a blanket on Maria to cover her up. He left the apartment around 3 a.m. and drove back home. Around 8 a.m. the next morning, he had no way to get a hold of Maria since she had left her cell phone in his car, so he drove his car back to her apartment. Irving knocked on Maria's door for 3 to 4 minutes, loud enough that a neighbor heard him and asked what he was doing. He explained he was trying to reach someone inside, then look through the window. He noticed the bathroom light was on, which he thought was odd, and then he noticed the screen for the window was on the floor. Irving opened the window and crawled into the apartment. He noticed a set of knives on the kitchen floor, then saw blood in Maria's bedroom, and eventually found her body with one of her nipples cut off and placed on her chin. He called 911 and then spent 10 to 12 hours at the police station where he cooperated with detectives, allowing them to search his home and business and giving them the clothing he had worn the night before as evidence. During the cross-examination, defense attorney Dale Rubin grilled Irving for over 2 hours. He focused on Irving's story of hitting Maria, as well as Maria seeing other men during and after their relationship, accusing Irving of becoming jealous. He also zeroed in on Irving telling detectives that he would sometimes black out when he was drinking, which he said happened the night he hit Maria. There were questions about Irving's testimony as well. He told detectives that the night Maria was killed, the couple had left the restaurant around 2 a.m. But the restaurant manager testified there was a receipt of their bar tab at 8:32 p.m., leaving a few hours between Maria receiving her last drink and the couple leaving. Irving also said he went home that night because he had money from the couple's business in his car that he was worried about leaving overnight in El Monte. The defense pointed out that he had left the money in the car throughout the day while the couple had gone to the doctor's appointment with their son, to Toys R Us, a Denny's for lunch, and then later at that restaurant. Irving also spoke about Maria's blood being found in the front passenger seat of the car, a Nissan Armada. He told investigators that Maria would sometimes masturbate while riding in the seat and may have done so while menstruating. Irving Bruno's cross-examination took almost a full day in court. Finally, the trial moved on. After Irving's testimony, prosecutors took the jury and the judge to all three of the California crime scenes in Hollywood, El Monte, and Santa Monica to see where the victims and Gargiulo lived at the time of each crime. Gargiulo's lawyers were present, but Gargiulo was voluntarily absent. He also objected to the jury being allowed to see the location during the day, noting that the murders occurred at night, and quote, "What the jury is going to see during the day is not going to be the same exact way as it would be in the evening as far as visibility and viewing the building." Once the jury viewing was complete, the lawyers, jurors, detectives, and Judge Fidler returned to court for the final stages of the trial. In our next episode, we wrap up the final witnesses, closing arguments, and the jury's verdict with a possible death sentence on the table. I'm Kelly Hyman, and this is Once Upon a Crime in Hollywood, The Hollywood Ripper.